Just over 63 years ago now, a young 12-year-old girl would go away to spend some time with her grandmother in Wilbur, British Columbia, and she would go to play with some of the local children and wind up spending the night. The following day, however, circumstances would lead to her disappearance, and even though one of the largest searches in British Columbian history would take place, and even though there were so many stories that didn't line up, a family to this day has still not received any answers as to what happened to their daughter and their sister. Hello, my name is Lance, and welcome to episode 132 of Gone But Never Forgotten, Nobody's Story Makes Sense, The Disappearance of Brenda Byman. Brenda Byman was born on March 10th of 1949 to Hilda and Ingvar Byman. Brenda had four siblings, Doreen, Albert, Audrey, and Verna. The family lived in Invermere, British Columbia, Canada, in the southeast corner of the province. Hilda, in a 2012 story that was special to eno.ca, remembered Brenda as a beautiful, sweet, and shy girl. She said that for much of her life, Brenda had very much been a homebody, staying around the house, but often staring out into the night and the night sky with amazement and wonder. Hilda remembered that when she got pregnant with Albert, her husband Ingvar asked her what she was going to do. Ingvar knew that the plan was for Hilda to take a break from child rearing because Brenda was attending school and Doreen was a toddler. Hilda said that even though Brenda was only 6 years old, she had spoke up and told Ingvar that everything would be fine. She said that she would help with the new baby and that she would even wash all of his diapers. As a joke, Hilda remembers that Ingvar had then purchased a small washtub and a scrub board, but that everyone was shocked when Brenda was in fact dead serious. Every day that she would come home from school, she would wash Albert's diapers on her small scrub board and even get angry if someone else did what she referred to as her job. Her family remembers that Brenda just adored Albert and that she would push him around in his carriage and announce her younger brother to everyone and anyone that she came across. At the age of 12, Brenda spent the weekend of Mother's Day in 1961 with her maternal grandmother in Wilmer, British Columbia. To be honest with you, aside from the fact that Brenda went missing, this is about where the similarities in stories, opinions, and theories all come to an end. The rest of the story seems to divert slightly depending who you speak to and depending what perspective of the story you get. The only things that are for sure in this case are that one 12-year-old girl went missing, and the lives of four other teens, their extended families, an entire town, and even area of British Columbia was forever changed because of what we are about to talk about. First, I want to set the scene for you on Wilmer. Wilmer is a small settlement that is near Invermere, which is, of course, where the Byman family resided. The Bymans, though, did previously live in Wilmer. Wilmer was founded in 1886, and it overlooks the Rocky Mountain Trench. Wilmer is approximately 5 kilometers to the southeast of Lake Enid, which is the center of our story today. Wilmer today has a population of under 250 people, and back in 1961, it's believed that the population was likely closer to between 50 and 100 people. So, as you can imagine, the community was tight-knit, and everyone knew one another. So, I will start with the story that's been presented for the 63 years since Brenda disappeared of how things unfolded. This story seemingly came from one perspective alone and showed a lot of bias and what appears to be a lot of missing facts. The story was that Brenda was at her grandmother's home in Wilmer, and she was invited over to her friend Vivian's home, which was super close by. The original plan, according to that published story, was that Brenda was simply going over to Vivian's home to play some cards. Later that night, though, Vivian called Brenda's grandmother and asked her if Brenda could spend the night. She was allowed. The following day, Brenda, Vivian, and three boys, John Carson, Edward Carson, and Elwood Godlin, all left together on what would amount to a 5-kilometer hike towards Lake Enid. On the walk back, Vivian and her boyfriend, Edward Carson, had left ahead of the other three, leaving Brenda with John and Elwood. It was reported then that Brenda realized that she was going to be late getting back to her grandmother's home and meeting up with her parents who were coming to pick her up, and so she decided to leave John and Elwood on her own and head back to her grandmother's house. Reportedly, the boys had yelled after Brenda and told her that she was headed in the wrong direction, but Brenda either did not hear them or she completely ignored them and continued walking alone. The last thing that the boys saw of Brenda, they said, was her disappearing into the distance beyond their scope of sight. However, they did say that they had heard voices and a car door slam shut a short time later down the road that she had been walking on. That was the story that had become the main story that was repeated and republished for many, many years. I want to take some time to look at some of the divergences of the story, though, that have in fact come to light over the years. The first person that I want to take a look at here and share her story is someone that we have not even talked about, and someone that doesn't even seem to be mentioned in most of the published stories that I came across. That person is Connie Barrett, Vivian's younger sister. I only came across Connie's version of events when I stumbled across an interview that she did with Eve Lazarus on her podcast called Cold Case Canada. Connie says that the story had a lot of fallacies within it that didn't fit the truth and that she knew because she had personally lived that truth. Connie said that it was she who had invited Brenda over to her house. Connie and Brenda had known one another for their entire lives. They had attended school together in Wilmer, they had been to one another's birthday parties, and they had essentially grown up together, even though they now lived in different towns. Connie said that the sleepover was something that was long planned for. She said that the sleepover was a large part of the reason that Brenda had been at her grandmother's home in the first place. Connie also said that Brenda's parents knew very well that the sleepover was going to happen. Brenda had never stayed the night before, but there was a lot of excitement surrounding this sleepover. Connie went on to say that Brenda had come over to her house on Saturday afternoon and that Connie, Vivian, their brother, and their parents had all been at the house, and then that some friends had also come over and that the kids had played cards. Connie said that the following day, the idea of going for a hike came up, but that Connie had chosen to instead go with her father rather than going on the hike. Connie said that her father was going to work on cupboards for a friend and that the friend had two young children, and she had chosen to go play with them instead. Brenda, though, had apparently decided to go with Vivian on the hike towards Lake Enid. regardless of how Vivian and Brenda wound up in the company of John, Edward, and Elwood, and we will talk about another perspective on that later, this gets us back to the same story. Vivian and her boyfriend Edward had left John, Elwood, and Brenda, and then Brenda had gone missing. When Brenda did not return to her grandmother's home, the police were called, and her grandma called her uncle to come up and help to try and find Brenda. That is where we will diverge to another detail of the events that led up to Brenda's disappearance. This telling comes from John Carson. John Carson said that on the Sunday that Brenda went missing, he was at home with his brother Edward and with Elwood when Brenda and Vivian stopped by the house and asked if the boys wanted to walk with them towards Lake Enid. John says that he remembers the day well and that it was cold, but the sun was shining. The boys agreed to go for the hike. John repeated the fact that Edward and Vivian had left on their own on the way back and that when they had left, John said that he had had sex with Brenda. John said that the sex was consensual and that it was also not the first time that he had had sex with Brenda. For me, this is an intricate part in the story. The fact that John, who was 17 at the time, admitted to having sex with Brenda, who was 12, is a fact that makes me stop and think for a moment. Why would John admit to that? There are a couple of schools of thought that come to mind. First, John was simply being honest and forthright and telling the police honestly everything that had happened on that day. The second thought that I have is that perhaps John was covering his steps if the police did indeed come across Brenda or her body so that they would not believe that he had sexually assaulted and killed her when they found evidence of the fact that she had had sex before she was taken or murdered. Finally, my third line of thinking is that perhaps John was being cunning and that he was admitting to something that was certainly not on the up and up, even though at the time this was not seen as statutory rape. Perhaps in doing so, he believed that the investigators would not believe that he was holding any information back. I will admit that I find it difficult to believe that a shy and very timid 12-year-old girl would consensually have sex with a 17-year-old boy, but as we all know, it does happen. From everything that people have said about Brenda over the years, though, this seems like a stumbling place in the story. It doesn't jive with the character of the girl that we are talking about. At that point, John's story seemed to match up with the bulk of the story that we have already talked about. He said that Brenda was worried because she realized she was going to be late back to her grandma's house and she had headed down the road. He repeated the fact that he and Elwood had heard a car door and heard voices, but they could not make out what was being said or who was speaking. John said that about a half hour later, they were stopped on the road by Brenda's uncle, who was looking for Brenda. John said that they had told him that Brenda was behind them on the road, but that she had been walking the wrong way. This is the point where the police get involved, and this would become a massive investigation. To this day, the search party that came together to look for Brenda is believed to have been one of the biggest in the history of British Columbia. The search took place over rugged back roads, alongside roads in the area, and there were even planes in the sky helping to try and locate Brenda. Brenda's family knew that time was obviously of the essence because they knew that Brenda was afraid of the dark, and it was also very cold outside. That night that Brenda went missing, temperatures did drop to near freezing, and it was believed that Brenda was certainly not dressed or prepared for the conditions. Many people from the surrounding area left their jobs and spent days looking for Brenda, or any sign of Brenda, and it was said that within 2 days, approximately 16 kilometers of area had been swept in depth by the search parties. At the time, it was said that the search was so in-depth that if there was even a small weapon or a piece of evidence, it would have been discovered because people were taking Brenda's disappearance very seriously. While the search was taking place, there were many pieces of clothing found, including a shoe that was believed to have possibly belonged to Brenda. Brenda's parents, however, confirmed that the shoe was not hers. There were also hunting knives, combs, and even the skull of another missing person from many years earlier that were found, but not one single shred of evidence that proved that Brenda had even been in the area at all. Divers were even brought in to help in the search, and they searched Lake Enid, and everything seemingly on land, in the water, and in between was searched extensively. All, sadly, to no avail. During that time that the searches were going on, tempers and arguments and rifts started to flare that, even to this day, believe it or not, have not died down. Connie said that Brenda's Aunt Mary had even come to the Barrett home and insisted that she be able to look in their sawdust furnace for remains of Brenda. Connie said that Mary had used sticks to sift through all of the ash, and she had extensively searched there, believing that the family had covered up Brenda's death. Vivian and Connie's mom and Mary had been long-time best friends, and their friendship came to an abrupt end because of these circumstances. Mary and others then took it upon themselves to go to the Carson home as well, and they forced their way in to search the family's deep freeze. The hunt was certainly on, and it seemingly was a witch hunt. Now, Connie did lay out that this was the end of friendships that had existed for many years and even decades, but I cannot say that I would have necessarily acted any differently. You have to realize that this was a family who had lost a 12-year-old girl. They were obviously beside themselves with grief, and they were willing to flip over every stone and dig through anything that they could to find answers. Now, don't get me wrong. I do obviously completely understand that what they were doing was not legal, and that if there was innocence on the part of the Barretts and the Carsons, this would certainly be damning to see a family wholeheartedly believe that they were covering something up on their own property. Obviously, the police did not have enough evidence to conduct these searches legally, and so the Bymans wanted to check things out before it was possibly too late. You cannot help but to feel for everyone involved. Connie says that back then, as today, everyone just wished that Brenda would be found, or Brenda's body would be found, just so that there would be some sense of closure in the case, because tensions were flaring, and even are still flaring to this very day. Everyone seems to believe that someone is hiding something. After 16 days, the RCMP would make the difficult decision to call off the searches. The numbers of people searching had obviously dwindled over time as people needed to return to work and provide for their own families, and there were just no leads to follow and not one clue or piece of evidence to inspire more searches. Brenda had seemingly vanished. There had even been sniffer dogs that were brought in to follow what was believed to have been Brenda's scent, but the dogs had stopped short when they reached an area where it was feasible that Brenda could have gotten into a vehicle. There was doubt, though, that even that could be trusted, because by the time that the dogs were brought onto the scene, that particular area had been trampled so much that it was believed that perhaps the scent had been tampered with to the point that it just wasn't recognizable any longer. One thing that doesn't seem to be covered very much that I could find is the way that the police seemed to conduct their business at the time. We've seen many times across cases, especially in this era, where investigators will center on one person, and they will become obsessed with that one person, even in the absence of proof. In hearing over the years from the two boys at the center of the disappearance, John Carson and Elwood Godlin, it appears the police were very intent on proving that the boys knew something, and especially that John Carson had killed Brenda. John has said that the police showed up on that Sunday at his home and that they had immediately demanded to know what he had done to her and done with her. John says that he was then taken to jail and placed into a cell for a week. He was only permitted to leave the cell to force him to take part in the searches for Brenda. He said that over that time he was yelled at, screamed at, questioned for hours, and even awakened from sleep and forced into more interrogations, all because the police believed that he was the sole answer to whatever had happened to Brenda. Elwood has since passed, but his brother Russ has spoken out in recent years on his behalf, and he has said that he was very upset that his brother was seemingly thrown under the bus with everyone else. He said that Elwood had also told him that the police were incredibly forceful with him. Elwood had said that the police would split the boys up into different search parties and that they would be roughed up in the process. He himself was shoved to the ground whenever they came across any hole in the ground, including gopher holes, and screamed at. He would be asked if that hole was where they had buried Brenda. Russ has said that his brother was not the type of person who would have, or even could have, kept a secret such as this for his entire life. He said that with everything that Elwood had been through because of this case, he most certainly would have confessed to anything if he knew anything. Russ said it was hard because people were quoted as saying that Elwood was the only one of the boys that ever showed remorse for what happened to Brenda, and that's hard for Russ to hear and read because remorse is obviously what you show when you are guilty. Russ says that Elwood was saddened over the fact that a young girl had gone missing and saddened that he couldn't do more to help. Russ said that many people believe that one of the major reasons that this case was never solved was because the police were convinced from the very beginning that John Carson had killed Brenda either on purpose or accidentally, and because of that, they didn't follow up properly on other leads and other avenues that had presented themselves. Something else that has been widely reported is the fact that neither Connie nor Vivian were ever questioned about Brenda's disappearance. However, Connie says that it is categorically untrue. She said that both she and Vivian had been questioned on the very day that Brenda disappeared and many times in the years since. There are reports that both girls were questioned inside of police cars without an adult present in order to try and pressure them. John and Elwood, over the years, even tried their best to solve the case so that the heat and the rumors would finally come off of them. They had hired private investigators and even paid to have land excavated on the former Byman property, which I will get into more in a minute. In the early 1990s, John, Elwood, Edward, and Vivian all took polygraph tests, and the RCMP would come out and say that all four of them had passed the polygraph tests and that they had officially been removed as suspects within this case. Now, 63 years later, there is still no resolution within this case. There has been no sign of Brenda, no sign of Brenda's remains, and no movement in a case that has been looked over time and time again. Part of the problem for sure is that over the years, the case files have been physically moved and passed from force to force and likely largely destroyed. However, there appears to be five main theories that remain within this case. The first is that Brenda had indeed walked off in the wrong direction when she left John and Elwood, and that she had succumbed in one way or another to the elements, whether that was the weather, the terrain, or wildlife in the area, such as a grizzly bear or a cougar. There is little denying that in the area that Brenda disappeared from, it wouldn't take very long for her remains to have been completely destroyed by wildlife in the area, if this were the case. The second theory is, of course, that the one that is most widespread reported on. That is the belief that John Elwood, or some combination of the two, had killed Brenda either on purpose or by accident, perhaps while having sex with her, and then they had hidden the body somewhere. This is obviously what the police believed, with the limited evidence that they did have. As we have seen in the past, oftentimes the easiest answer is the answer that investigators wind up going with, and because John and Elwood admitted to having been with Brenda, and John admitted to having sex with Brenda, this was the easy answer. The third theory is the one that seems to be believed the most by the Barrett and Carson families. There is a growing sentiment that Brenda's father, Ingvar, went looking for Brenda, and that when he found his daughter, he had killed her in a fit of rage and then disposed of the body himself. As I mentioned, John and Elwood had even paid for an excavation at the former Byman home because the growing belief is that Brenda's body was actually brought back to the family home and thrown into a man-made well. There are reports and beliefs that there was a well on the property that was filled in around the time that Brenda had disappeared. The excavation would only find a pair of jeans, which may or may not have ever been tested, and John and Elwood admitted that they did not know or remember where on the property the well had been. The fourth theory centers around the story from the boys that they had heard a car, and that they had heard a car door slam, and that they had heard voices. It's believed that Brenda was picked up, either by a stranger or someone that she knew. This certainly could also tie into Theory 3. The belief that she got into a car that day would explain why there was no evidence ever found, including clothing or even a strand of her hair anywhere. There were articles at the time where the police were searching for the driver of a light blue sedan or station wagon with a white top. That car had been reported to have been seen on side roads on the day after Brenda disappeared, with a man in the driver's seat and a girl in the passenger seat. I could not find any reports on whether that driver or vehicle was ever found. The fifth theory stems from Brenda's sister, Verna. Verna says that she doesn't even believe that Brenda ever went to Lake Enid. She believes that Brenda had died in some way at the Barrett home on the night before she was reported as missing. She says that there is no proof that Brenda had ever been to Lake Enid or the area that everyone was searching, and because Brenda had never asked herself if she could go on the hike, that made Verna suspicious. Eventually, as they do, things died down in this case. The Byman family would put an ad in the newspaper every year on Mother's Day to keep the story and to keep Brenda in everyone's mind in hopes that someone would say something. Even though there were deep feelings of hurt, many of the families actually remained in the small community together and managed on some level to coexist. In 2001, on the 40th anniversary of Brenda's disappearance, the case again hit the media when a man came forward and stated that when he was a child, he was out in the bush in the 1970s with two friends, and that they had come across a disturbed grave that they had poked at with sticks and found skeletal remains. The man said that the friends were not supposed to be in the area, and out of fear of their parents, they actually made a pact to never tell anyone. Obviously, even though there was hope, the man had no idea where the bones were located that they had found, and the remains that they had found were never located. It has now been just over 63 years, and the investigation has gone nowhere, and sadly seems like it might not. Brenda's file still says missing, believed dead, and the four other teens, all but John Carson, are dead. At this point, there are a lot of faded memories. Many of the major players have passed on, and there is a lot of resentment still held in regards to this case. Sadly, a small town over 60 years later, and many families have found themselves entrenched in a war that sadly seems like it will never be won. As someone who has never been in a situation like this one, and certainly I hope that I never am, I cannot help to think about the hurt and the heartache that was felt by everyone, and is still felt today. One thing is certainly true, somebody somewhere likely knows more to this story than the rest of us, but what we have is people who have lived their entire lives judging and hating and hurting because of their opinions of what happened. We see many cases today where families of victims forgive guilty parties and attempt to move on, even if only for their own peace of mind, and I hope for the people still alive that lived it, and the people of future generations, that they are able to somehow find some peace, even without the truth. As I said earlier, if I was in this situation, I think that I would have acted in the same way that the Byman family acted if my daughter had disappeared, and if I was the Carson or Godlian family. I would certainly be pained by the stress and the anger that came out of this towards my family. There's truth here, and the sad reality at this point is that we may never know what that truth is. I just pray for peace for all of these families in some form or fashion. Matthew chapter 11, verse 28 says, "Come to me, all you who are weary and burdened, and I will give you rest." There is so much weariness and so much burden in a case like this one. People who are judged guilty may in fact be innocent, but at the heart of it all, a little girl went missing and was never found. I pray so much for peace for everyone involved and honesty. There may still be someone out there that is still alive that knows the truth. Unfortunately, there seems to be no way to unlock the secrets that people choose to put under lock and key. Hopefully, you don't keep this podcast as a secret. The best way to support this show is to give us a 5-star review, give us a follow, and tell others about Gone But Never Forgotten. The more people that listen, the better chance there is, if even fleeting, that someone will hear an episode like this one and share that morsel of information that they might know. Jump over to our socials as well and chime in with your thoughts, cases you would like to see me cover, or even just a like and a share. Audience participation is hard to find in this world, and I love to see it. In the meantime, and in the in-between time, I just want to thank you for listening to Gone But Never Forgotten, and as always, I appeal to you to always try to be better. I'll see you next week.